Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the very first day of December. Your health care costs under the Affordable Care Act, and also we'll look at your health care costs under employer-sponsored health insurance this hour. We have two guests with us who have different viewpoints on the issue. It's hard to believe it's been more than 5 years now since President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law, and people have different opinions as to whether or not the cost of premiums have increased. We will have two columnists with us this hour who have different views. We'll be speaking first with Chris Flavelle. Chris is an editorial writer on domestic policy for Bloomberg View. Before that, he worked at ProPublica. He's written for Newsweek, Slate, The Washington Post, produced videos for the New York Times website, and is a contributing writer for The Big Money. Later in the hour, Megan McArdle, who is a Bloomberg View columnist who writes on economics, business, and public policy. She is the author of The Upside of Down. We're particularly interested in hearing from those of you who are getting your health insurance through the Affordable Care Act, what kind of plan you have, if you have seen health care premiums increase. There are some interesting statistics. We'll start before we speak with Christopher. He writes a recent article saying that figures released late in October by the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services listing average 2016 premium increases for the 37 states whose exchanges are run by the federal government suggests that there are some increases. Some of the states will see, he says, eye-popping increases, 36% jump in Oklahoma, 32% in Alaska. But in other states, the average cost of the benchmark plan, which is the second cheapest silver plan in a given geographic area, will fall by 13% in Indiana, 8% in Mississippi, 1% in Ohio. On average, the benchmark premiums will go up by 7.5%. So we'll examine all of that. Why up high in some states? Why not in other states? And he also looks at the cost of employer-sponsored health insurance and what increases we've seen in that regard. Christopher, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, our great pleasure. So let's break down these numbers a little bit. Overall, we're seeing some states with, you say, eye-popping increases. Others we're seeing, going down, falling significantly, and overall 7.5%. Why is there such variation?
So the thing to remember is, in the first year, and arguably the first 2 years of Obamacare, insurance companies offering coverage on the exchanges really just had to guess what their medical costs would be and use those to then figure out what to charge in premiums. And even allowing for the huge margin of error in that kind of a guess, they then had to say, probably let's err a little bit low because that way you get more business, right? You tend to want to outprice your competitors. So what happened was a lot of these insurance companies guessed too low, some guessed too high, and then you saw big swings, really big, in some states over the first 2 years. In 2015, they could correct a little bit because they had partial data from 2014. And then for the premiums that we're talking about now are for next year, for calendar 2016. They now have pretty good data, at least on the people who have signed up so far. They know what they cost, mostly, and they can much more effectively guess what the cost be going forward. So really the numbers you see now reflect nothing more than insurers saying we now know what it will actually cost us to cover the people who want to sign up for these plans. And so really the swing you're seeing up or down reflects insurers going from a state of almost no information to pretty good information.
Mm-hmm. So how expensive are the premiums and what kind of health insurance are most people getting on the exchange?
You know, there's a big swing. I think people tend to be motivated by the cost of the premium. The way these numbers usually presented is, as you mentioned in the intro, the benchmark plan, which is the second cheapest silver plan, usually the way that cost is measured. But a lot of people go, I think, to the exchanges and just shop based on premiums. Now, the way these plans are divided is a bit complicated. I think it's one of the problems with the exchanges. You've got tiers based on metal names, gold, silver, bronze. I think people who are cost sensitive, they go in and they say, well, I don't want to splurge, so I'm going to get a bronze plan. And I think they don't always realize that that means they'll get lower premiums, but the flip side is when they actually use the care, their out-of-pocket payments, deductibles, copays, that kind of thing, are going to be higher.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the big problems isn't so much cost. The premiums, almost everyone on the exchange is subsidized. They get federal money to reduce the actual out-of-pocket payment for premiums. But only some of them get federal assistance for their cost sharing, those deductibles and copays. They can be so, so high. And I think people, if they had a better sense of what they were signing up for when they bought the plan, and they if they knew that, say, a silver plan will have lower out-of-pocket payments than a bronze plan, and a gold payment, lower payments out-of-pocket than a silver plan, more might buy those gold plans. And I think that sort of the whiplash they get isn't so much the premiums, but the realization that they've signed up for a plan where the payment structure is, it's not meant to be deceiving, but it certainly is surprising to people.
Mm-hmm. Almost everyone is subsidized. That's interesting.
Yeah, the number is 86%.
Wow.
So if you make less than 400% of the federal poverty line, you get you're eligible for some subsidy to make sure that your cost of premiums is below a set share of your income. There's some people, 14%, who are over that line and still use the exchanges. For them, when premiums go up, they bear all of it. And so it's a big deal. But really, they're a slim minority. And to be candid, the law isn't really designed to help those people. I think the idea is those who have lower incomes need more assistance.
Mm-hmm. What about the overall cost of health care, Christopher, and how does that figure into a rise in premiums? Do we have costs under control more so than we did, say, 10 years ago?
So the sort of meta story of health care in the last 5 years, in addition to Obamacare, has been that there's been a slowdown in cost growth. Usually, in the past 20 years, say, the cost of healthcare has grown faster than the cost of inflation by a fair margin. That hasn't gone away entirely, but it's slowed a lot. What we don't yet quite know is how much of that was the recession and how much of it is other things, chiefly Obamacare. There's several provisions in Obamacare designed with varying degrees of success to change the way doctors practice medicine, to coordinate care, to reduce unnecessary tests. In theory, that is helping to, the phrase of art is, bend the cost curve. We really won't know until we're a few more years away from the recession, if in fact that's it. Because if that's it, it's a lasting thing. If it's the recession, it'll bounce back. So we won't know. But for the moment, cost growth in overall healthcare services is fairly constrained.
Mm-hmm. And do we have numbers? We have some states, I can't remember the exact number, who set up their own state exchanges, and many others, 37, I believe, who are on the federal exchanges. Mm-hmm. Are there cost differences between those two categories or not?
You know, the states doing it themselves are all over the place. I don't have an average in front of me. But I think the thing, the point is, whatever the 2016 number is, we even that won't settle it, right? We still have to see what the 2017 number is. We still have to see how many insurers stay in and stay out. So, look, certainly the premiums are important, but I would suggest it's not the only important thing and maybe even not the most important thing. I think by far the single most important variable is, are young people going to sign up? And if they're not signing up, why not? One argument is that the cost and premium is too high. I don't think that's true. The government has these numbers. They say that if you're a 27-year-old, this is for Wisconsin, if you're a 27-year-old with an income of $25,000 a year, after your federal subsidies, the cost of your premium for the benchmark plan is $143 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Not a huge amount. So I don't think the argument that cost is keeping folks away from signing up is that convincing. I think the issue is more a cultural one. I think there are people who are millennials or a bit older who have just grown up with the idea that they're healthy and don't need insurance.
Right.
And changing that mindset, even with the federal penalty that you have to pay if you don't have insurance, is going to be hard. Whether that works, whether that shift happens, I think will be much more important to the success of Obamacare than whether premiums go up by 5% or 10% or 15%.
It's a rough thing. I remember when I was young, it's a rough thing to think that you're going to need health care, right? It's just hard to get that through a young person's mind.
And even if you think you're going to, you also, you know, wages are mostly flat.
Yes.
Hard to find a good job. Rents are high.
Right.
It's hard to justify spending even that small amount when you know, you're squeezed elsewhere. So I think, you know, I still think the rational choice for most people is almost always going to be have health insurance because you just don't know.
Absolutely.
But I can see why people might be reluctant to come to that conclusion on their own.
Your article is interesting in that you also looked at the cost of employer-sponsored health insurance and whether or not those costs have gone up significantly. Have they?
They always go up, and the question is how much. I think the increase from 2014 to 2015 was in the sort of mid-single digits. It depends whether you're looking at family coverage or single coverage. But it's not, you know, it's not worrisome. There were periods 10 years ago where it was twice that. So the only issue remains, is it so expensive that people start opting out of it? That was the big concern with Obamacare. People, either employers would stop offering health insurance or workers wouldn't want it because it would be too expensive. I don't think there's any evidence of that. And the other interesting point about the cost of employer-based care is it's really the only useful way to gauge the cost of coverage on the Obamacare exchanges is compared to what? Compared to job-based coverage. And it's roughly the same. If you look at the cost borne by workers for monthly premiums, the average is roughly as much as you pay for Obamacare coverage after federal subsidies. Mm-hmm. So it looks like, you know, everyone's kind of in the same boat. The big question is always, how do you bring down the underlying costs? Obamacare is trying that, and we don't know yet if it works.
Donald Trump has said, Donald Trump says a lot of things, but he has said over the last few months, these kind of, as you call them, doomsday warnings, premiums are going up 35, 45, 55%.
So, you know, I don't know if, it's hard to know how much Donald Trump has to add to this conversation. He is, I think, an interesting embodiment of the general sense that costs are out of control.
Right.
And he's not, you know, to his credit, you've got to be liberal in interpreting what he's saying, but he's not totally baseless in that certain kinds of costs are indeed skyrocketing. Premiums are not them, but deductibles are way up. And I think people have to do one of two things, either just stomach the idea that you're going to have to pay on the average healthcare plan a lot of money before you actually get insurance coverage, or you're going to have to be a little more selective in shopping for that coverage, whether that means if you've got a plan through your work, trying to tell your boss that this isn't how you want your coverage to work. If you've got a plan on the exchange, I think there's, again, people maybe have to realize a little more that the idea of buying a bronze plan because it sounds more fiscally prudent isn't always a sound idea. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you spend more upfront and get a gold plan, for example, you won't spend as much out of pocket. But it's a new law.
Right.
And so I think charitably, people are still learning how it works, including those who are covered by it.
Yeah. We're going to welcome phone calls for you. We have two guests, different viewpoints on the Affordable Care Act and whether or not the cost of coverage has gone up significantly. Christopher Flavelle is our first guest, and they are both from Bloomberg View. Christopher is an editorial writer on domestic policy. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we'd love to hear your experience with the Affordable Care Act or with health insurance in general, however you get it, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. We have tons of them coming in and some messages on Facebook as well. We start our calls with Randy in Kewaskum. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I mean, this, looking at it, this has been nothing but a disaster. My insurance may have slowed down some in the increases, but, I mean, I'm up to a $6,800 deductible. I've got co-pays on everything. Basically, with the coverage I got, if I get really sick, I might as well go out in the woods and sit down beside a tree and die, because I can't afford to go to a hospital. I'm reading stuff. We're looking at 40% increases next year, and the big bite's going to come in 2017 when the under-the-table subsidies to the insurance companies to keep costs down go away. I'm reading things that they're projecting in Washington. They're projecting somebody like me, 100% increase in families, a 50% increase in 2017 after the election.
Randy, what kind of coverage do you have?
Well, I don't know. My coverage must be wet cardboard because it doesn't. I mean, I'd be better off just dropping the coverage, paying the fine, and putting some money away to pay for stuff because it doesn't cover. It doesn't cover,
Yeah, all right. It would be helpful for us to have an understanding of what you have. But, Christopher, can you comment?
Yeah, so one of the biggest problems that we haven't discussed yet is the way the exchange is supposed to work is people can go back every year and shop around and find the best price on a plan that meets what they want. The government has said only about 1 in 3 people who use insurance through Obamacare actually go every year. Not surprisingly, it's a real pain. But I think the trick to making this work will be people, number one, shopping around every year and saving money. And then number two, as I was mentioning earlier, finding a way to make people more aware that the kind of plan you buy will affect your co-payments. I don't doubt for a second that what we just heard is a fair reflection of a lot of people's situations where they've got co-pays or deductibles that are huge, but it's possible that if you buy a different kind of plan, you may have slightly higher upfront payments in terms of premiums, but when you see a doctor, your costs aren't as high. And I think people are still grappling with how to be that kind of informed consumer to mm-hmm. make those kinds of choices, which they haven't really been asked to make in the past.
Yeah. And if from my understanding from people who have worked with the exchanges and on the whole are satisfied with them, is that it is very difficult to work through on the phone with somebody to get your plan right and to get the deductible right. Consumer education seems to be one of the problem areas here.
Yeah, and look, the transaction cost is huge. One of the arguments in favor of Medicaid or Medicare or that kind of government system is whatever its other flaws, that level of decision-making isn't imposed on consumers. And I think a really interesting and tough question is, do people want all those choices? Do they want to have dozens or hundreds of plans to choose from with different deductibles
right.
and premiums?
Mm-hmm.
Or do they want, as most employers do, someone to sift through it all and say, this is a bad plan, don't go with that, and we're putting you here instead, and don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people may have overestimated just how much choice people want in health insurance.
Thanks, Randy, for the call. Andy in Gays Mills. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hey, my question, I have a employer-sponsored health care. It's $3,000 deductible this year, which I am stomaching. but the question that I have is, could they mandate by the federal government to have you eligible to go to any hospital across the United States, and would that bring down costs? Because we actually are limited. We have to go in this little area, and out in the rural areas, lots of times you have to drive quite a ways. But couldn't they mandate it all the way across, and wouldn't that bring costs down overall?
Yeah, one of the ways insurers try to save costs is, in fact, by negotiating with hospitals and saying, we will send people covered in our network to your hospital if you'll give us this better price. And so the flip side of that is if you don't happen to be near one of those hospitals or you don't want to go to one of those hospitals, you'll often have to pay more to go, the phrase is, out of network. It's an open question whether that's a better system than just giving people equal access to all hospitals and not having that sort of bargaining happen. I think the system that we have is such that if you didn't have that kind of preferential selection by insurance companies, you'd probably have higher costs. And the question is it worth it? I don't know the answer.
Hmm. It is amazing, and you know this better than most of us because you follow this really closely, Christopher, how darn complicated all of this is. We have to have, in addition to being one of the most costly health coverage systems in the world, one of the more complicated.
I think the only good way to understand U.S. healthcare, as I can see it, is that the U.S. spends way more per capita mm-hmm. on healthcare than almost any developed country. In fact, any developed country. And if you try to answer the question of what it gets for that extra money? One answer is quality. I think if you've got health insurance in the U.S., you're getting access to pretty good quality care. That isn't all of it. Other countries have great care, too. I think what you're getting is choice. You're getting the ability as a consumer or as an employer to go to one of many different insurance companies and have them provide your coverage. And the really tough question, again, is what's the real value of that choice? Is it worth paying more for? If you just cut out insurers entirely and had the government negotiate prices with healthcare providers, you would have no choice, by definition, at least in terms of who paid, but you'd also pay less. So sort of the value of that overhead system of people between you and your doctor or your hospital and what it adds to your experience, you know, it's hard to answer. And I think if Obamacare 5 years from now, 10 years from now, looks like it doesn't work out, many people will revisit the importance of that level of choice.
Right. Andy, thanks. Dolores in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for and your guest. Thanks so much for having us. It's so important. My problem is I did have the Obamacare, and then I dropped it. First of all, real quick, I voted for Obama because I thought he wasn't going to have Hillary Care. I call this Hillary Care. I believe in the single payer. My employer does not provide insurance for anybody, and now we're all scrambling around because it's October to look for the right plan. And some of them are hitting, you know, 62, 65, and you're going to the Medicare, Medicaid. I dropped it because I couldn't afford it. To me, it's not affordable. One of my coworkers is a bartender. He has cancer. He has not paid the Obamacare because he can't afford that. So he's waiting till the end of the year to see how much it's going to cost. Will he have to pay that $1,000? So it's not really affordable. It's, yes, there's choices. I had the bronze plan. Went to Common Ground. It's really frustrating. It's frustrating for all my coworkers. I work in a restaurant, so, you know, some days my tips are great, some days they're terrible. You know, it's very confusing. It's very frustrating, and we don't have health care. To me, so I went to the doctor the other day. It was about 2 months ago, actually. I got a bill for $200. I spent 10 minutes in the office, so that's like $20 a minute. So I'm extremely frustrated. I've been dealing with this forever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really affordable. And the gentleman that's on the phone is saying, well, it's only $150 a month. Well, if your rent is so much and your cost of food is so much and you don't own a home, it's not affordable to you. You take your chances.
How much,
bartender.
Dolores, how much were you having to pay a month?
I'm $180.
Mm-hmm. Christopher, how does that sound?
Look, I mean, there's no question about it, right? And if you're tight for money, then any amount you got to pay every month is mm-hmm. going to sting. But as the situation you described illustrates, if you also have to see a doctor, then it's, you know, hard as it is, you got to try and balance the likelihood of using care and the cost if you do against what you'll have to pay every month to have insurance. $180 is certainly a lot. The federal numbers show that 78% of people, based on their income, can get coverage for $100 a month or less after federal subsidies. You know, could you make it free? Yeah, you could find a way to make it free. Is it politically palatable? Probably not. And everyone in this system has to make that call before the end of the open enrollment period. What is more valuable, the knowledge of having insurance or not, and then carrying that risk? The only thing I'd say, I don't want to sound like a defender of the law, but before the law, most people didn't have the option to get coverage at that cost, especially the gentleman you mentioned who has cancer. If you've got a pre-existing condition, previously that would have made most insurance unreachable, and now you can get it. But there's no way around it. If you've got to pay $180 a month and you've got to worry about rent and other stuff, that's a tough call. I guess the only silver lining is at least it's a choice people have now, and before they often didn't.
Right. One more call for you, then we're switching guests. Same topic. Ann in Random Lake. Hi.
Hi. My husband and I have completely private health insurance. We just pay for it completely ourselves. We've always chosen a high deductible, and a recent letter from our insurance company, it sounds like, I've not analyzed the letter, but right now it sounds like we're going to be forced to have a lower deductible, which I assume is going to raise our premiums. So if true, I was wondering if the guest might be able to briefly explain why, you know, the government is basically forcing us to have a higher premium than we would normally want. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ian.
Yeah, in the law, there's an annual cap on the amount that an individual or a family can be made to pay out of pocket, deductibles, copays, that kind of thing. I don't have the number in front of me. It's in the several thousand dollars. I don't know, obviously, details of what you're describing. Maybe your plan was grandfathered from before Obamacare and had a deductible that was above that limit, in which case it's being brought down. The limit imposed by the law on deductibles is still pretty high. And so it doesn't at all preclude high deductible plans. In fact, more and more people every year are in those kinds of plans. And look, if you're happy with it, that's great. I think the much larger policy problem is people who are in high deductible plans and don't like it because they think the premium looks enticing and they have to use care and they realize they've got to pay a fortune out of pocket before they can use it. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, the desirability of those plans varies from person to person. I think they're probably the future, and I don't know if that's a good thing.
Thanks, Ian, for the call. Chris, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, we'd love to have you on again sometime, and we can talk for a full hour. We're getting different viewpoints this hour about whether or not premiums have risen substantially for the Affordable Care Act. We're also, of course, you can't just talk about that. You also have to look at job related insurance as well. Have those premiums gone up? What about deductibles? What about those of you who are on the Affordable Care Act? Have you found that it's good for you? Is it problematic? Have your premiums gone up quite a bit? We're looking at numbers that were released recently by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services showing that it's great variation from state to state, but on average, benchmark premiums will go up by 7.5% in 2016. The program is just really getting underway. Does that seem reasonable or does that seem high? Of course, it would seem high if you're facing a 7.5% increase, but some states are more than that. We continue our conversation, different viewpoint. Megan McArdle is with us now, Bloomberg View columnist who writes on economics, business, and public policy. She's the author of The Upside of Down. She has previously written for Newsweek, The Daily Beast, The Atlantic, and The Economist. And we're delighted to have you with us. Megan, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is all so confusing. You just hear from some people who say their deductibles are now $6,000 and they got off the plan because they can't afford it. And you look at these numbers and some states are jumping way up in the cost and some states are, it's going down. It's just all over the place. Let's start with, on average, benchmark premiums going up by 7.5% next year. Is that the way you read it?
Yes. I mean, that's the average. That's a weighted average by the population that's covered in each state. So, you know, some states had very high increases, but they tended to be states with both high and low increases. So there were a couple states where it fell. There were a couple, one state where it went up 35%. And that tended to be at the kind of outlying, the states with high and low population, basically, are the states that saw the biggest shift.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not actually a surprise because that's where you have the smallest pool. And, you know, economists talk about something called the law of large numbers, which is that the bigger your insurance pool, the less variation you have. So the answer is this isn't a huge surprise. But of course it is very distressing for the people who are having the insurance increases.
Yeah. The high deductibles of the exchange policies, how do they compare with employer given health insurance? Is there a big disparity here?
Yeah, it's much, the deductibles are much higher than they were. Deductibles, the cost sharing. What you've seen, what you also saw with these plans, and something that has been less reported about, people tended to report the headline figure. What they didn't report was that these policies are also shifting. Now, we heard in 2013 when Obamacare launched the exchanges, we heard about narrow networks, and that just meant that, you know, you might have Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield individual policy, but if you bought the Obamacare policy, fewer doctors would be on that. They were offering lower reimbursements, and fewer doctors were willing to take it. Well, now they've shifted to what you might call ultra-narrow networks, which is to say these are basically mostly, at this point, pure HMOs mm-hmm. with no coverage at all for going outside of the network. And that is a big change. So if you, you know, want to see a specialist who isn't in your network, nothing that that specialist does will be covered. And that is a pretty big shift. And again, goes to just a lot more cost sharing, a lot more restriction in order to keep, you know, even that 7.5% premium, if they hadn't done these switches, that increase would have been much, much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing to keep in mind is that the benchmark plan, it's totally defensible that HHS uses this benchmark, but it's kind of a weird metric. And the way that you can imagine this is if I said to you, you know, the cost of say, pasta has gone up only by 7.5% because we looked at all of the cheapest brands, and you can buy a brand of pasta for 7.5% more than a brand cost last year. Well, maybe you like Barilla, or you like Ronzoni, or whatever it is that you like to eat, right? Your cost of pasta, if you're brand conscious, if you care about the actual product rather than just a generic thing called pasta, may have gone up by much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is similar to what we've seen with this. The benchmark plan is defined as the silver plan. You know, they come in four tiers, bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. It is the second lowest cost silver plan.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, last year you may have had one that covered certain doctors, certain treatments. It had a drug formulary you liked. This year, the second lowest cost plan is probably a completely different plan that may have a very different assortment of benefits than you were getting last year. And so, overall, it's true that the plan premium, if you just want to buy whatever the second lowest cost silver plan happens to be, has only gone up by 7.5%. If you are more conscious about the actual insurance that you want, the doctors you want, et cetera, your costs may have, and indeed probably did, increase by more than that.
Why?
Because the people at the high end, the higher end of the policy, the more they're spending. Basically, the fundamental problem that insurers face in these markets, they're almost all losing money on these policies. Not every insurer, but the overwhelming majority are. So there is a pool that's designed to insure insurers against excess losses called a risk corridor. And it's supposed to be revenue neutral, which means, you know, some people have a better than expected experience and pay in. Others have a worse than expected experience and pay out. But overall, it's supposed to about net out. Well, it turned out that they had about eight times as many people making claims as paying in. And so given that, you have basically the situation where almost everyone's losing money, and so they had to figure out what to do to stem those losses. They took a bunch of approaches. They raised premiums. They narrowed the networks. And the fundamental problem is simply that the pool is much older and thicker than anyone had anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, they're spending more money, which means they need to charge us more money. Unfortunate reality of insurance. It's not a very lucrative product. Their margins tend to be in the low single digits. You know, most people tend to assume that insurers are just wildly profitable.
Yes.
And in fact, it's a pretty low margin business, and they basically expect that in most years, within a few years, they're going to pay out pretty much everything they took in premiums except for a small amount for overhead and profit. And because of that, you know, the costs had to go up. There wasn't really any other way to handle it.
Hmm. Well, we have several Facebook comments on this, and I assume that you would say that they're off the mark here. Someone writes, I'm guessing that the insurance company profits must be way up. I hardly know anyone who's even met their deductible. What's happening with the insurance company's bottom line? I think they're getting rich off our misery.
So one thing we should be clear on is that the individual market is actually a pretty small overall part of the insurance market. It's obviously very big to you if you are one of the people who's insured in it, but most of what they do is they sell to employers, they sell to Medicaid, you know, they sell to various companies that are in the business of, you know, various institutions and governments that are in the business of insuring people. And so insurance companies are still profitable. They're not losing money overall, but they're losing money on these policies. And what they're saying is a combination of that they had more sick people than expected, that people just cost them more than they had anticipated, and also that there is some evidence that people have figured out how to game the system a little bit, which is to say, if you, say, leave jobs, you're eligible for COBRA. Well, if you're healthy, you think, you know what, I'm starting a new job in 2 months. I'm gonna go without COBRA. I have 2 months to decide anyway. I'll pay the premium if someone in the family gets sick. But if you're already sick, you say, well, I better get that COBRA premium paid right now. And they're seeing something similar in the individual market, which is that people who are sick are buying that insurance. People who are basically healthy are deciding to go without it, maybe buy later. And that even that people who look at it and say, look, I'm not going to meet my deductible by the end of the year, I'm healthy, may just be stopping paying their premiums. And those two things are causing costs to rise much more than they had expected.
Megan McArdle is our guest this half hour, Bloomberg View columnist who writes on economics, business, and public policy. And we'll welcome, we have all kinds of calls coming in on this, as I expected we would. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Megan McArdle is our guest now. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Marty in Douglas County is our first caller for you. Hi, Marty.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks, Kathleen. I'm a big fan of the ACA, as is my husband, as are many of our friends. It completely changed our lives. I'm self-employed, so is my husband. Back in the bad old days, we had to buy our own insurance if we even wanted health insurance. Our last bills were $5,000 a year on a $10,000 deductible policy, so essentially it was catastrophic care only. When the ACA came into effect, our insurance company informed us that our premium was going to go up to $20,000. From the $5,000 with the $10,000 deductible, but we were able to get on, well, we got onto Badger Care, and it has been a godsend. I just went to a physical therapist this morning. I never would have been able to afford it to do that prior to this. We love it. We think it's great. Bravo. It has changed our lives.
Megan.
I think that, you know, this is something that we expected. You give people subsidized health insurance, people are going to be happy that they're not paying for health insurance. You have to remember there's basically two markets here. There's the Medicaid expansion, which a lot of states did, and those people are basically getting care for free. That's Badger Care. Then there is the ACA market, where the exchange market, where people are buying insurance. And what we're seeing in that market is that people who get large subsidies are pretty happy with it. So basically, if you make under 250% of the federal poverty line, that's about $13,000 a year for an individual, and then it's stepped up for people. So a family of four, it's somewhere in the range of $40,000 to $50,000. Those people are pretty happy with it because they get a very large subsidy. They're eligible for not just subsidies for the premiums, but for subsidies of their cost sharing that caps their cost sharing at about $2,500 a year. The people who are above that line don't seem to like it. Those people seem to be worse off than they were before. On average, you know, if you had a pre-existing condition, if you had not maintained insurance over the time, because people who had pre-existing conditions and had maintained insurance have been able to keep renewing their insurance since 1996. But if you hadn't done that, if you had been uninsured and had a pre-existing condition, those people were obviously much less happy than they are now. And then there are the people who are paying a lot more than they did. And anecdotally, we don't sort of have, it's hard to track exactly what happens to every individual, right? You can only look at these big averages. But anecdotally, in 2013, I got a lot of people emailing me to complain about premium hikes, but most of them were in fact just complaining about articles they'd read about other people who were having premium hikes.
Mm-hmm.
This year, my comments, my email, my social media are full of people saying, in part because the grandfathered plans are going away, are full of people saying,
you know, this is outrageous. I had a high deductible plan before that was costing me $100 a month or $200 a month, and now I have a high deductible plan that's costing me $1,200 a month. And, you know, I have had people report going from $400 or $500 for their whole family to $1,300, $1,400 for their whole family for what's essentially a narrower network of doctors and the same or higher deductibles. And so, you know, it's a mixed bag. It's, as with any government program, you've got winners and you've got losers. And it sounds like the caller is one of the winners. Mm-hmm. She's very happy with what she got.
Your colleague, the first half hour of the show, said, I didn't realize it was this high. Would you agree with this, that 86% of the people getting Affordable Care Act coverage get subsidies?
Yes, because the people who are not getting subsidies have by and large declined to buy it. Only a fraction, only about a third of the people who are eligible have purchased Affordable Care Act coverage. But of the people who are eligible, most of them are qualifying for at least some subsidy. And indeed, when we look at the numbers, it is heavily weighted towards people who qualify, who are under that 250% of the federal poverty mm-hmm. line, who get very large subsidies. People who are closer to, say, $40,000 a year for a single, who are eligible for some amount of subsidy, which is really just capping their expenditure at about 10% of their income, those people seem less interested in buying it.
And, Megan, what's the story with young people? Are they signing up?
No. Initially, the administration had said that they needed 40% of people between the ages of 18 and 35. That's the youth market, otherwise known as the young invincibles market, because they don't buy insurance because they
right.
think they're never going to die.
Mm-hmm.
They'd initially, because that is the you know, the bulk of the uninsured were concentrated in a few groups. Poor people, obviously. People who, immigrants had, you know, if you looked at, uninsured is sort of a catch-all term that can cover a lot of things. Most people who were uninsured for only a few months. If you looked at the long-term uninsured people, the people who were going uninsured for more than a year, it was heavily weighted towards immigrants. And the young, who say, you know what, I'm held, I was uninsured in my 20s because I lived in New York State, which had a very expensive insurance market, and I just couldn't afford it, so I didn't buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Those people aren't, in general, they don't have kids, they're not eligible for large subsidies, and by and large, they're declining to buy it. We were supposed to get 40% of the market was going to be in that 18 to 20, 35 age group. Instead, it's more like 27%. And that doesn't actually sound like a huge difference. But in fact, it's almost 50% of the group that we needed are missing. And unfortunately, that's the part of the group that was expected to pay into the system rather than taking out.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the big reasons that the price of insurance is going up faster than people had anticipated.
Thanks, Marty, for the call. Let's go next to... my phones are kind of jammed here. Hold on. Let's go to Rod in Weyerhaeuser. Hi, Rod. Rod, I can't hear you. Are you there?
Yeah. Hello. Can you hear me?
No.
You can't hear me now?
No, I'm sorry. I can't hear you.
Okay, my phone screwed
up. Oh, no, it's not. No, wait. It was my fault. It's not your phone. It was me. Go ahead.
Well, okay. No, yeah. I had a question and a comment. I was just wondering what she thinks the prospectus is for going towards single payer, you know, insurance. And my comment was, too, what about these stipulations on people that, you know, fortunately that made lots of money, whether straight or crooked or honestly, and build places such as, like, well, California on these cliffs, and then it gets mudslide, wash away, and the guy says, well, so big deal, the insurance will pay for it, when everybody pays for it, the bottom line. I'm just kind of wondering on that.
All right, Rod. Megan.
I'm not exactly sure what the question is.
What about take single payer? Do you think we'll ever go to that?
Sure. I don't. And I don't for a number of reasons. So, first of all, people tend to think there's a lot of kind of eyeballing Europe and saying, well, Europe, they have single payer and insurance is cheaper there. In fact, most European countries don't have single payer to start with. And just to define our terms for listeners who might not be familiar with all of the ins and outs of healthcare lingo, single payer is where the government is where one person pays for the one entity pays for all of the insurance costs. That doesn't mean they're the provider. So England has a nationalized healthcare service. They employ the doctors. They pay for it as well. Other countries have where Canada has a single-payer system. The doctors aren't necessarily employed by the government, but the government pays all the bills for all doctors in Canada. Most systems are more like ours. What we have now with Obamacare is a hybrid system where you've got a role for private insurers, a role for the government, a role for individuals buying. And those systems, all of them cost less than ours does. Ours do. Ours is, you know, 5 percentage points of GDP, which is really the best way to measure this, is how much of your national income do you spend on healthcare? We are 5 percentage points of our income, or almost 50% higher than the next highest country.
That's a lot.
And so there's been an assumption that if we move to something more like the European system, we could get prices down. And the problem with that is that if you actually look at it, we don't have a healthcare cost growth problem. We're right actually down in kind of the middle to low end if you look at other developed nations. Our healthcare costs don't grow that fast. The problem is that they're high. And they're high because they grew really fast in the 80s. And no government, whether it is single payer, whether it's a hybrid system, whether it's nationalized, no government has actually cut their expenditure on healthcare. They've held down the rate of cost growth. But if we wanted to do that, we needed to do it in the 80s. The problem with doing it after it's already grown is that that's someone's income. So a doctor has gone to medical school or a nurse because all of our healthcare workers, from the lowest to the highest, are paid more than in other systems. You know, being a healthcare worker is a really good job here, and that's not true in most places. It's not, they don't tell people to go into healthcare because that's the one stable sector where you can always get a job and it pays well for someone of your education level. That's basically a U.S. phenomenon, not a worldwide phenomenon. So because of that, you know, do you say to this nurse who's taken out a mortgage, who, say, makes $85,000 a year, has taken out a mortgage based on that income, oh, your income's going down to $60,000 a year now because we need to cut healthcare costs? That's really politically just about impossible. Also, we've made decisions about things like building hospitals. If you look at American hospitals, you know, watch a foreign television show or a foreign movie, and it's really fascinating because the hospitals kind of look like they're in the third world, even when they're not. They're in France or Britain. And that's not to say that the care is substandard. You see a lot more things like wards instead of single rooms. We basically don't have wards anymore except for things like the ICU and the ER. You see things like just a lot less equipment. The buildings are less well kept up. Well, we decided to build those buildings. That's what all our hospitals look like now. You can't just go back and say, well, I guess it would have been cheaper to build open wards, so now we'll have them. It's cheaper to keep the buildings we have than to try to build a whole new hospital that's cheaper to run. There are also benefits, I should say, by the way, to single rooms like infection control that are really good, and there are good reasons that we did this. We made all of these cumulative decisions to pay our healthcare workers very well, to build these buildings, et cetera, et cetera. You know, ultimately, almost all the money, we like to think there's like a magic pot out there. It's in some greedy insurance executive's pocket. It's in, you know, some medical equipment manufacturer or pharma's siphoning it off. When you really get down to it, it's prices in the healthcare system. And hospitals, insurers, they don't have fat profit margins. Most of it is going back out the door to employees. And those are our, you know, our aunts and uncles, our mothers and fathers and cousins and sisters and all of those people. It's very difficult to cut those expenditures because of that. So that was a slightly long-winded answer, for which I apologize. Because of that, the price tag for doing single payer in the United States would be enormous. If you look at, we spend as higher percentage of GDP just to cover old people in this country as Britain does to cover everyone.
Yeah.
So we spend 7% of our GDP just to do our government healthcare system, which is basically veterans and seniors and some poor people. We spend more than Britain does to cover all of those people plus everyone else in the country.
Let's go to a Facebook comment from Alan from Illinois to get a sense of what's going on state by state. Alan writes, Blue Cross dumped the most popular plan, and the one they're replacing it with is this very restrictive plan. It has very few hospitals and doctors in it, and they raised the rate for it on top of it all. Is that peculiar to Illinois or widespread?
Nope, that is what we are seeing all over the country, and it goes back to the fact that they are spending, they didn't get the young people, they didn't get the healthy people. They're having what's called adverse selection, where people who are healthier are declining to buy or are stopping paying their premiums when it's clear they're not going to hit their deductible. Because of that, all over the country we're seeing the same thing. Prices they wildly underpriced it. I mean, in the defense of the insurance companies, they lost a lot of money in the first 2 years of Obamacare. All of them did. They can't keep doing that forever. They're not running a charity. even the nonprofits, they can't just keep losing money on these policies. And so what are they doing? They're narrowing the networks to control costs. They're narrowing what they cover to control costs, and they are raising the premiums. And between those three things, that's how they're going to bring the policies into line with spending, with the money mm-hmm. going out on healthcare costs matching what they're taking in on premiums.
Megan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Megan McArdle, Bloomberg View columnist. She writes on economics, business, and public policy. Earlier in the show, also from Bloomberg View, Chris Flavelle, editorial writer on domestic policy. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this interesting show. We need to do more of them on healthcare. We spent years doing show after show after show, and it's time to revisit the whole thing, I guess, if this hour is in any indication. Well, we have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we will return and speak with the author of Be Your Own BFF, Your Personal Guide to Becoming a Strong, Independent Young Woman.